So, over in Countercurrents, you have this. You've been writing about Michel Houellebecq, the French writer, and you also you sort of tie this in with Lovecraft as well. But the title about it is, you have the quote, "I get my kicks above the waistline sunshine." Isn't that from that song, "One Night in Bangkok"?
Yes, it is.
And it's called Michel Houellebecq's Sexual Anti-Utopia.
Yes, his anti-sexual utopia. Actually, there's a more subtle or more banal connection there, because the book he wrote after that, Platform. This is a review of the elementary particles.
So is that there? Is the I'm not I wasn't the book I'm fam more familiar with is book called Whatever.
Right. That, I think, is his first novel, and I believe this Elementary Particles is the second. His third book was called Platform, and I believe that is the book that deals with sexual tourism in Thailand. So that was sort of like a little.
Oh, so that's why you put that there. Well.
Well, not why, but I mean, that's a connection that comes up there. I mean, the more obvious thing was that he's plugging, he presents this horrific picture of liberalism. Again, it ties in. The worst thing that can happen has already happened. I mean, but with the kind of conservative angle, that there's a definite period in history that you can identify, and he identifies it as being the 68ers, the what we in America would call the baby boomers. The period that's documented by the television series Mad Men, for instance.
And he's
You know,
I
the
mean
idea.
you
Go ahead.
make com I mean I don't think he's affiliated with any political movement, but I think you say that a lot of the themes in his work are similar to the new right. But one of the things I know Houellebecq is well known for is he compares basically the sexual revolution to capitalist economics.
Right, yeah. His idea, I don't know how original it is with him, but his idea is that the sexual revolution, by dissolving, and this is where he ties in with the new right, of course, is that by dissolving the ties of marriage and family and social relationships and so on, purports to be liberating, but what it actually does is it sort of frees people up to become consumers. Sex being, of course, the ultimate consumer item, but it's just consumers in general. And this is the essential trick that's involved in here. And this is, ultimately goes back to the French Revolution. That period of time. As it goes forward, Burke complained about the dissolution of what he called the little platoons. The small social groupings from the family upward, and all this was swept away. So they were simply the citizen, the absolute individual, and the state, which was the up above, and you directly interacted with the state. There were no intervening institutions, and then that's been sort of like instantiated more and more. And by the time of the 60s, the sexual revolution, this was finally reached the level of sexuality. But sex becomes simply another commodity that an absolute, untied individual may choose to participate in.
So he says
And
it kind of the sexual revolution. It's sort of, does he say it dehumanizes people by sort of turning them into it turns them into an economic entity in a sense. Is that what he's trying to get at?
yeah, well, it's the ultimate penetration of economics into the last vestige of humanity. I wanted to point out that this is the sense of the title, The Elementary Particles, that people have been, the title of the book in the UK was Atomized, which emphasizes the same thing, that under the guise of liberation, social ties have been atomized, and we now are just elementary particles just sort of circulating around and bumping into each other and so on. What I point out in the review, and I think this is what Welbeck is talking about, is that this looks good. This gets back to the idea of, you know, politically correct academics and what they think we should be doing. It looks good because it seems to be what Nietzsche is saying. It seems to be what the bright intellects are saying, you know. All this stuff is myths and lies and social convention. Sweep it aside. Let's be authentic. Problem is that Nietzsche was writing about the potential Superman, you know, a small elite that could actually benefit, that needed to be liberated from society's bounds. And what's happened is that that's been co-opted, to use a 60s phrase, by the establishment, the capitalists and so on, to basically reduce everyone to that level. And Evola talks about this in Ride the Tiger, that everyone has freedom thrust upon them. People didn't want freedom. They wanted to just be left alone. They wanted to just lead their lives and be more or less happy. But they were told, no, Nietzsche says you should become Superman and become what you are and surpass yourselves. Well, people can't do that. You know, that's beyond most people. Nietzsche knew it was beyond most people. He didn't prescribe it as, he diagnosed this as happening in society, but didn't think it was a good thing. And that's what's happened to our society. Everybody is essentially taught that they're all perfect, unique snowflakes. And their job is to instantiate themselves and become a unique individual. Well, most people can't do that. Most people would be better off growing rutabagas. You know, most people would be better off out in the fields, hoeing, not doing what they're doing. You know, I mean, Tito Perdue, for instance, in various of his books like Reuben and The Morning Exercises, is right on about this. He's got it exactly. I mean, most people were better off, you know, just growing crops.
So
everybody has to become an urban consumer and pursue the good life. It's just absurd.
It's about this man who is it's kind of about how miserable his life is.
Well, I have to confess, I have not yet read Platform. In fact, I start off my review there as talking about how odd it is that I haven't read any other of his books.
Oh, you've only read The Elementary Particles.
I've only read The Elementary Particles. It's I may go on to read further, it's odd that has happened. And one of the commentators pointed out to me that the title of Platform is a pun in French that means flat style, that characterizes Welbeck's writing. So that was all news to me because I haven't read him in French or in English, so that's all new to me. Well, I should point out that I have another book coming out eventually, by the end of the year, I think, which will include that review and many other pieces that I've written more recently for Countercurrents. And
so, do you plan on reviewing whatever?
I may do that. I'm actually, you know, I mean, the thing is, I tend to be an antiquarian in an odd sort of way. I mean, all the pieces, for instance, in the Eldritch Evola are, as the title might indicate, with, using words like Eldritch, are sort of backward-looking. You know, it's an attempt to look at the old days. There's a piece on a movie based on Mickey Spillane's Kiss Me Deadly, for instance, There's a piece on a book that appeared in 1904, I think, called Philosophy 4, by Olin Wister, who's better known as the author of The Virginian, which is the original Western novel. It was made into a movie and a television show, and it's kind of legendary.
And
which relates to a number of themes that that occur in Homo and the Negro and throughout my work of you know the role of the Judaic, the role of the homoerotic. You know, it's interesting. The Virginian, the classic Western, is a clear homoerotic novel. People think Brokeback Mountain was some sort of, this is an example of something they're talking about. People talk about Brokeback Mountain as if it was this bizarre deviation from normal culture in the name of political correctness and liberalism and so on. If you look at the original Western, The Virginian, it's no different. It's the same novel, as a matter of fact, ultimately. That's an example of what I'm talking about. And yet, on the other hand, if you look at Philosophy 4, which is another book by Owen Wister, the author of The Virginian, it's essentially the same plot as The Social Network, except that The Social Network inverts everything. So in The Social Network, the Jews win. So my essay on that is called The Winkle Twins Win One. It's in Philosophy 4, the two Aryan college students outwit the Jew, and in The Social Network, the Jew outwits the two Aryans. So they match exactly. So this is how our culture has developed. You know, at one time the establishment writers like Owen Wister wrote books like that, and they wrote books like The Virginian, where manly men are out in the West without women. And today, we have a culture with Brokeback Mountain and The Social Network. So there are these. What I do in The Elder Jebel is explore those kinds of timeless themes.
And you reviewed this book. It's by Jeffrey Dennis. I have actually not familiar. I'm not familiar with this book until you wrote about it. But it's called We Boys Together: Teenagers in Love Before Girl Craziness. And you talk about some of the themes of the. Talk about the Männerbund.
Yes. This is an interesting thing. Conservatives will tell you that we should go back to the good old days of family entertainment. And if you look at what passed for family entertainment in the old days, it was very different than what we have today. Somewhere around near Pearl Harbor, just as America was an isolationist country that had to be propagandized and bullied into World War II, the fight for you-know-who, the movies had to do the same thing. And the movies were completely transformed. The movies in popular culture. Popular books for boys and movies for boys and the whole family. Prior to that time, projected this idea that manly boys hung out with other manly boys and with men.
Are you talking about in a homoerotic sense or a platonic sense?
Well, you know, obviously, I think, you know, these at the time, of course, it had to be, of course, platonic. We could argue about what it really amounted to, but certainly, shall we say, homoerotic. In other words, the idea was that let's look at it in the opposite direction. The sissy in these movies and in these books, the sissy is someone who's interested in girls. I know that sounds strange, but think about it. Go with me for a moment. Think about it. The sissy is the guy who hangs around with girls, and we all know this from our childhood.
And today, when people associate the word sissy with a homosexual,
yeah, well, exactly. The characters that seem clearly to be homosexual, we would call homosexual, they didn't really use those words back then. This is part of the same thing, that the rise of psychoanalysis, the Jewish science of psychoanalysis, comes about in the 30s and 40s. So this is part of the same change. If you go back before then, you see, you know, the rise of the psychoanalytical notion, the homosexual, who's a deviant and a threat, coincides with the rise of the idea that America should abandon isolationism and save the Jews in Europe. These ideas are all interconnected, you see. This is what the conservative fails to understand. The conservative, you know, wants to go back to the 1930s, but he wants to continue to demonize the homosexual. He doesn't understand that these ideas are interconnected. It's all part of the same mentality, you see.
So are you saying that... you're saying traditionally homosexuals have been more masculine you're saying they've traditionally been more masculine than, say, the, like, womanizer?
I mean, that's one way of looking at it. The that actually kind of ties it in with Welbeck's antisocial utopia, I Get My Kicks Above the Waistline Sunshine, sort of.
And Welbeck, is he not... He's been rumored to be homosexual, but I don't know.
I've never heard that rumor, but you know what? It ties in with everything I've ever said, because at some point everyone gets that rumor, because
everyone who's great gets that rumor.
right, exactly. Anyone who has an original idea, anyone who challenges the establishment gets that rumor. Which, of course, is not to say that I'm endorsing the idea, but that's the reason why there's the idea that, you know, all the great artists were homosexuals, you know, all the great politicians were homosexuals. Well, you know, that comes about because if you look around in the world today, I mean, that's always the first kind of rumor that that comes up. But I just want to say, read that book. That review is not in the Eldridge Envelope, but it will be in the next book. But read that review and read that book and look at the movies. And, we know this very well. We know this ourselves, because any time anyone looks at these old movies, everyone starts giggling, you know. Even today, a movie like Fight Club or The 300 or Beowulf, as soon as you see a movie like that, everyone starts giggling. Oh, they're all gay.
Fight Club is, I think it's probably one of the more subversive movies that's managed to get through Hollywood.
Yeah. It also raises the same sort of issues, actually, as Welbeck raises, or some of the same issues, because of course it also deals with, you know, consumerism and the idea that, you know, people are buying stuff to, you know, essentially create an identity,
and
have a real identity, and the way to create that real identity is basically to fight other guys. But
you have a kind of a funny line. It's kind of vulgar, but you say that. You say conservatives think that a man who is a mentor to boys is basically like a dirty homosexual who deserves to be... You basically, this is vulgar, but you say it deserves to be raped by Negroes.
Do I say that? Did I say that somewhere?
In your articles about
conservatives. Did I say that somewhere? I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I'm trying to recall the exact wording of that, but I think
you say conservatives appoint the quote unquote Negro as the ultimate form of masculinity,
right?
To punish the homo.
Right.
Why do you come to that conclusion?
well, you have to read my books going back to that original manifesto, but yeah. That's true. I'm trying to think of the exact thing, but I do say that in a recent piece in a footnote somewhere, that the traditional role models in Aryan culture, you know, the priest, the scoutmaster, the teacher, the little league coach, and all that have all been completely tarred with the idea that they're all child molesters. Think of it. I mean, anybody who announces in public, you know, I think I'll work with boys. It's hard to understand where any of these people are coming from anymore.
Yeah, I mean,
what body are they drawing from to get scoutmasters? Is anybody actually
saying
I want to
get scoutmasters?
And that problem
is boys grow up having no male role models,
and therefore they have no male role models. And maybe, may actually be something we have to face, that, you know, maybe... there's some sense in having an interest in other men.
Conservatives are like pederasty is like their absolute like worst nightmare.
Well, you know, let me align myself with Pope Francis on this. You want to talk about traditionalism and you know, what's more traditionalist than the Roman papacy? Well, of course, people say they're all child molesters anyway. But that's my point. Pope Francis has taken this rap recently for saying something that Alan Watts, among others, has said for many years. The weird thing about the church is that it's become a sexual regulation society, and you would think that of the seven deadly sins, there's really only one. And what Pope Francis has suggested is, you know, maybe we should take a break from this and look at other sins, you know? And, of course, the people who continue to think that only sexual sins are important, are just, of course, assume, well, he must be a homo.
Yeah.
That's
like
the fall position on everything. But this is my point. I mean, you know, at some point you have to say, you know, let's look at something else for a change. Let's look at
something like the sin of usury.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or, but even without usury, I understand where you're getting at, but, even just restricting yourself to the seven deadly sins, there's greed, there's sloth. I mean, when was the last time people say, oh, you're a Catholic? Well, I know what that means. You're against abortion, you're against homosexuals. Why don't people think, oh, you're a Catholic, you're against greed? Oh, you're a Catholic, you're against sloth. That's a deadly sin. That's just as deadly a sin as lust, whatever lust means. You have to spell that out, what counts as lust. But these are all seven deadly sins. They're all capital sins. They're all mortal sins. They all send you straight to hell. Why isn't there a pope who devotes himself to sloth, to combating sloth? I mean, it is a sin. I mean, it is a teaching. I mean, why is it, as Alan Watts said back in the 1950s, the church has become nothing but a sexual regulation society? Alan Watts said this, if you say people are living in sin, you know what that means. It doesn't mean they're engaged in a conspiracy to sell adulterated bakery products. You know what living in sin means. There's only one sin. There's only one sin. And what's the thing that exercises everyone today? Gay marriage. It's exactly what Alan Watts said. Living in sin. That's the only sin.
I mean,
the only thing anyone cares
about. With some
of
those people, everything about society can be in total decay, but the biggest threat to civilization is two men getting married.
The fact of the matter is, if you want to look at facts, is that the lowest divorce rate in the country is in Massachusetts. Now, the reason for that, of course, is Puritanism and Catholicism. So either the WASP Puritans, who, of course, despise divorce, and, of course, we know that's terrible because we're all liberated now. And the Catholics, of course, won't allow divorce. And again, we're liberated. We know that's terrible. But nevertheless, that tradition remains in Massachusetts, which has gay marriage. If you look at the rates of divorce, the highest rates of divorce are in the Bible Belt, which, of course, makes sense because as far as I can tell, having been raised as a Catholic, as far as I can tell, the only reason they have Protestantism is to get divorced. I mean, that's all they care about. Until historically, that's all Protestants cared about was getting divorced. Now they've decided that they're the representatives of marriage. I mean, I don't understand this, but I mean, if you want to have a solid marriage, go to Massachusetts. if you want to increase your odds of getting divorced, go to the Bible Belt.
And there's just something about the culture of the sort of evangelicals that I find it kind of vulgar, actually. In the South, those people. Some of those people.
Yeah.
There's just something kind of vulgar about it.
Well, this is something I've observed before, that in general, that it's like the perspective where you look at the lines that go into the distance and converge. As liberalism goes on, people become, well, more and more liberal. And if you look back, people who in the past seemed to be in the forefront of liberalism seem like conservatives. So if you look at, you know, John Steinbeck or Jack London or Karl Marx, you look at them and suddenly they seem like very conservative guys, relatively speaking. You know, Marx is full of all kinds of stuff that would get you fired from an academic position today.
I mean, a lot of people like to. I mean, I'm not a Marxist, but Karl Marx had many things to say that were totally insightful.
Well, let me say this. I've already alluded to this, but I mean, Karl Marx. There's a book written by a guy named Peter Sajak, I think, back in 1976, called Crooked Paths, that looks at liberalism, Marxism, and neoconservatism. And he's my source of the quote from Marx, which I've quoted before, and in a way actually summarizes my entire position, which is, if you just redistribute income without changing society, the same shit just starts again.
Well, it's not.
That's a profound comment that my entire current thought project could be summarized as. You know, in other words, if you just go back in time to some favorite point, it'll just start all over again.
I mean,
you
I'm running out of time, but I don't want to go off on a whole tangent about economics. But the thing about redistributing wealth, redistributing the wealth, but it's about who the wealth goes to, which people get the wealth.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's, Marx's point was that if you redistributed wealth equally, as the people he's talking about were these primitive communists who thought, well, we just redistribute everything, you know, people will be equal. He said, no, it doesn't work that way, because if you just give everyone an equal share, everyone will have $20. And the same shit will start all over again, right? So you have to change society and change people to make them into the future socialist man. If you just give everyone equal shares, that doesn't change anything. Everyone's going to be equally powerless, and you'll be in the state of nature. This is what happened in the Soviet Union. You know, this is what happens when the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, you had the disappearance of the Soviet state, which seemed to be a good idea, but that left everyone prey to the oligarchs. So, of course, the oligarchs took over. This was exactly what Marx called primitive accumulation, right? There had to be some point in the past when everyone was more or less equal, but then some people got power. You know, they had more weapons than someone else or something like that, and they took everything else. And that's the real situation of primitive existence, not this kind of Ayn Rand sort of, you know, everyone has contracts and everyone acknowledges everyone's rights. I mean, that's absurd. We were told, they were told in the Soviet Union by these Randian types that, oh, you just get rid of the state and capitalism will reemerge. No, capitalism doesn't reemerge. Oligarchy reemerges. You know, Marx knew that. Marx was smart enough to know that. You can't, if you have no protections in society, then the strongest will prevail. You know, somebody who's stronger than you will take what you have, and now he'll have more. And that will give him enough money to just pay someone else to do his bidding, and then suddenly he becomes the oligarch. That's how things started. But yeah, so I mean that's an example of how there's plenty of old time stuff that's perfectly valid and useful today, and this mentality of political correctness where we can't read anything that's not, whether you're conservative or liberal, there's still this mentality, well, I can't read that because he's Marx, he's a communist, or I can't read Jack London because he's a racist, I mean, that's the worst thing of all. I mean, that's where the left and the right in the old days
are on the same page. Jack London was a racist and a communist, the two worst things.
Exactly.
Or the worst thing would be a racist, communist, and a homo.
which is probably almost everyone. I mean, in the old days, I have to look at Marx sometime to see what's
yeah, we really covered it all in this interview. We covered the traditionalism, the homos, the Marxists. We covered everything. Well, James O'Meara, it's been a great show.
Well, it's been a great thing to talk to you again. Always a pleasure, and I hope to talk to you again in a few months when yet another book is on the horizon.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.